Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Aujourd'hui, les plateformes de formation en réalité virtuelle comme Resil aident les sportifs professionnels et amateurs à s'entraîner pendant qu'ils récupèrent après une blessure. S'entraîner dans le métavers permet aux sportifs blessés de continuer à travailler leur concentration et leur temps de réaction pour pouvoir affiner leurs compétences et reprendre leur sport avec confiance. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast lifting the language barrier to show you the world through its media.
Радіо Тегерану.
Ми не вторгались на територію України.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 9th of April, these are our main stories. A total eclipse of the sun has been experienced across North America, bringing temporary darkness to tens of millions of people. The Israeli Defense Minister has said that it's the right time to do a hostage deal with Hamas. Donald Trump appears to have resisted pressure from right-wing Republicans to endorse a nationwide ban on abortion. Also in this podcast,
I have fatigue so bad, even just changing a pillowcase on a bed, it's breathless. Can't walk far, even to a local shop, which isn't far, I can't walk.
Researchers have found that people with long COVID had signs of inflammation in their blood, which could help the search for suitable treatment. Tens of millions of people in Mexico, Canada and the United States have witnessed something spectacular, a total eclipse of the sun by the moon. That's when the new moon moves between the sun and Earth, blocking out the sun's rays and casting a shadow on parts of the Earth. It started in the city of Mazatlán on the west coast of Mexico. As the moon loomed over the sea, hundreds gathered at the beach, including the Mexican president, to see the darkness at noon.
Oh, my gosh. You can look at it right now without the glasses.
Holy,
it's dark.
There's the diamond ring!
It looks like right after sunset, you know, that darkness. And the sun's covered. It's beautiful.
There's a sunset, sunrise in every single direction. People are losing their minds. It is very exciting. I can see stars and planets. It feels like there's a really bizarre twilight sunset in every direction. It doesn't make any sense.
Just over half an hour later, it reached the United States. Our correspondent Nomia Iqbal was in the city of Mesquite in Texas.
It's happened. I'm going to take my sunglasses off. Wow. Oh, my gosh. People have got their phones out, and it's just amazing. You can see it's like a halo around the sun. And the moon, they're aligned, and it's now moving through the clouds. And we're in total darkness. Children just standing up in complete awe. It's thrilling. It's a really thrilling moment.
Next in Arkansas, a mass wedding marked the moment, in the words of the song, a total eclipse of the heart. And then finally, 30 minutes later, Nada Taufik watched on at Niagara Falls as the state of New York was plunged into darkness.
You can hear the cheers. You know, there it is. It's peeking through the clouds. Mother Nature is teasing us. There it is. Wow, that is spectacular. Oh, wow, that is fabulous. Here we go. It is fully on. You can see it fully now. You can see it now. Mother Nature is truly teasing us today. Earlier during the partial eclipse, it peeked through. It's peeked through again. So there you go. All of the people who have gathered here, they weren't shortchanged at all, getting to experience totality here and that absolutely bright corona.
For thousands of years, total solar eclipses have fascinated and also frightened people here on planet Earth. They are major astronomical events. Our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh, has more details.
A total eclipse is one of the universe's great natural spectacles because of an almost uncanny cosmic coincidence. At the moment just before totality, the last chink of light seems to increase in brightness, forming what's called the diamond ring effect. But that's just the lead-in to the real showstopper. That's the sight of the solar atmosphere around the moon. It's normally not visible because the brightness of the sun washes it out. But because the moon is exactly the right size and exactly the right distance from the Earth, it blocks off the dazzling part of the sun to reveal a vision of the moon as a gigantic, shimmering black pearl hanging in the darkened sky. If the moon were ever so slightly larger or closer, then it would block out this incredible spectacle. If it were a little smaller or further away, the tiny amount of light from the sun's bright disk would wash it away.
Our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh. Abortion rights are likely to be an important issue in the American presidential election in November. Now, Donald Trump, who secured the candidacy for the Republican Party last month, has offered his opinion on the matter. Mr. Trump was speaking in a video statement released on his social media site, Truth Social.
My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both. And whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state. Many states will be different. Many will have a different number of weeks, or some will have more conservative than others, and that's what they will be. At the end of the day, this is all about the will of the people.
I asked our Washington correspondent, Tom Bateman, why Donald Trump was saying this now.
Because he wants to be re-elected as president, and the fact that he has been involved or was involved in appointing the three conservative Supreme Court justices that helped overturn Roe versus Wade, that was the landmark 1973 Supreme Court ruling that enshrined and protected the constitutional right to an abortion. That was overturned in 2022, and Donald Trump had always said that that was part of his campaign when he was first elected president, but it has become increasingly challenging for Republicans, as many have been punished at the ballot box over that position. And in effect, the issue of harder rules and tougher laws on abortion bans has not played for Republicans in a way that they might have liked in terms of elections. So what we've seen is Donald Trump really equivocating, sort of wavering over whether there should be, for example, a nationwide ban on abortion at a certain term during the pregnancy. And also has not committed himself, basically. So what we had today was him saying, clarifying for the first time, that he backed the decisions being made by the states. And therefore, he is effectively saying there shouldn't be a nationwide imposed ban on abortion. He'd been asked about whether or not he considered 15 weeks to be an appropriate time limit and abortions to be banned after that period. It was thought that he was sort of leaning towards that position. But now we know he says that that shouldn't be done nationwide, that it should be up to the state. So he is in effect moderating his position from where he's been before. And it shows, I think, the degree to which he is strategizing ahead of the presidential election. The Republicans are accusing him of basically letting down women who want to have the right to have abortions.
Tom Bateman in Washington. Next to Gaza, Palestinians who've been returning to the wrecked city of Khan Yunis have spoken of the devastated landscape they've found after months of intense fighting there. Many residents found their houses in ruins, with others saying they couldn't actually locate their homes. One resident, a mother of four, said the city smelt of death. Israel says its troops have been pulled back from southern Gaza to prepare for the next stage of its operation against Hamas. Our Middle East correspondent, Lucy Williamson, reports from Jerusalem.
For months, Khan Yunis was a city of targets, its homes and hospitals seen by Israel as hiding places for Hamas. Today, its residents returned to pick through its shattered landscape, the concrete mountains that have replaced the city streets. All I can say is God help us, said Abu Saif Abu Mustafa. Khan Yunis has been destroyed. It's not fit for humans or animals. Another resident, Mohamed Abu Rizek, pointed out his house to the BBC.
I wasn't expecting this destruction. My house is here. Two floors are bombed. One floor is burnt and was completely destroyed. My wife was killed in the bombing while we were refugees. Our biggest request is that they withdraw from our land. There has been enough destruction and killing. It's better for us to have tents on the rubble of our home rather than being displaced.
The withdrawal of troops from Khan Yunis leaves Israel's army with just a skeleton presence along a central band of the Gaza Strip.
BBC Verify has been examining satellite images to assess the amount of damage caused by Israel's military action in the Khan Yunis area. Merlin Thomas has the details.
Looking at Gaza from space gives you an idea of the scale of destruction that the Israeli military campaign has wrought across the territory. We've been examining satellite imagery, comparing images from before and after troops advanced into Khan Yunis. Satellite images from just before the intense Israeli airstrikes in December show a residential district that was densely populated, with bakeries and mosques. Images taken last Wednesday show large swathes of the city now flattened. It's clear that row after row of buildings have been reduced to rubble. According to data analysis of other images, at least 55% of Khan Yunis has been destroyed. That's the equivalent of more than 8 square miles. One football stadium that used to be a lush, bright green patch among the concrete is barely recognisable. Much of it has been completely churned up and destroyed, like areas of farmland elsewhere in the Gaza Strip.
Against this background, the Israeli Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant, has told Israeli troops that it's the right time to do a deal to secure the release of hostages held in Gaza. But he said such a move required difficult decisions, as well as the approval of Hamas. Mr. Gallant's remarks come as talks continue in Cairo to achieve a ceasefire in Gaza and the freeing of the hostages. Qatar has been involved in the discussions. A spokesman for the Qatari government, Majed Al Ansari, told the BBC he was cautiously optimistic.
I can't go into the details of the said proposal, but what I can tell you is that it bridges the gap in a way that hasn't been done in the last couple of months, and we hope that would lead to more talks that would lead to a positive result eventually.
I asked our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher, why the Israeli Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant, was saying it's the right time to do a deal.
Well, it depends what perspective, I guess, it's being looked from. The way he was putting it was that with the withdrawal of Israeli troops from southern Gaza on Sunday, leaving just one brigade at the moment in the whole of the territory, it's a moment when Israel is in a position of strength from his perspective. He was speaking to army recruits that they've accomplished much of their mission. That's where he's coming from. And I mean, he was putting it not about the ceasefire, but about the freeing of hostages. And I mean, here, that has only become a bigger issue week after week, day after day. The protests just a couple of days ago were immense, the biggest so far. So the pressure building on the government has been intense. From Hamas, as we've had before, we're getting conflicting signals. Some signals, to be honest, not from Hamas itself, but from the mediators, from Qatar, from Egypt in particular, where the latest round of talks has been happening in Cairo, have already been very positive, saying, you know, that the optimism they're feeling, they haven't felt for some time. Now, I mean, we're hearing, as we have before, from Hamas sources that that isn't how Hamas is looking at it and that they're actually taking a more negative view.
And so how does this square with the calls from Benjamin Netanyahu for a continued offensive in the town of Rafah?
Well, again, I guess it depends the way that it's being looked at. From Benjamin Netanyahu's stance, he doesn't feel that he is saying anything different from what his message has been for some time. I mean, he upped the rhetoric in his latest address, saying that a date has been set for the incursion into Rafah. I think most people would take that with a pinch of salt. I mean, it's a military operation. Setting a date is a hard enough thing at any time, particularly with an operation like this. But, you know, the message was, we are going ahead. Now, that doesn't necessarily rule out a ceasefire. What Israel, the government and the military have been saying is, we're not against a ceasefire deal, not a permanent ceasefire for 6 weeks, something like that. That's what's being talked about. But we will go back and finish the fight afterwards. And that means Rafah to some degree. That's what Benjamin Netanyahu is still standing by and delivering that rhetoric. Now, that's uncomfortable for Israel's closest ally, the US, which has become far more critical in recent weeks of the Israeli government, and very much about any intention to go into Rafah that could cause more death and destruction there, where more than a million Palestinians who've been displaced from elsewhere are taking refuge. So this is not a message that America and Israel's allies want to hear at this moment.
Sebastian Usher in Jerusalem. It's estimated that 65 million people across the world are suffering from the illness long COVID, which has a range of symptoms including breathlessness, problems with memory, joint pain and gut or stomach problems. Tracy Evans from England is one of them. She spent time on a ventilator in hospital 3 years ago.
I have fatigue so bad. Even just changing a pillowcase on a bed, it's breathless. I can't walk far. Even to a local shop, which isn't far, I can't walk. I'm tired all the time. I have shooting pains all over my body. I've got really bad brain fog.
The symptoms can develop weeks or months after you catch the COVID-19 virus, and with no treatments available, they can last for years. So far, long COVID has proved to be very hard to detect. But now new research has found that the virus leaves telltale signs in patients' blood, which could be targets for treatments. I've been talking to our health reporter, Philippa Roxby.
It's difficult to measure the impact of long COVID globally, but what we think is that one in every 10 people who was infected by COVID could then have these long-lasting symptoms. And that's what long COVID is when the symptoms of COVID, and they can be anything from brain fog to fatigue to anxiety to muscle pains, when they continue for a long time afterwards. Usually it's for at least another 12 weeks afterwards. And for some people, they last for many months and sometimes even years.
And so far, what do we know about what causes long COVID?
Well, there's been a lot of research into it since the pandemic started. We're still in the very early stages of really understanding what causes it. But there are some things we do know. We do know that people can have indications in their heart and in their lung of scarring after COVID, and they can continue. We know that it can affect people who are very severely ill with COVID, but also people who were very mildly ill, just had mild infections. They can also be infected for a long time. We know that there may be something to do with blood clots in the brain that could be causing brain fog. But all these research findings are in their very early stages. There's still an awful lot we don't know. And scientists are very keen to find out, because clearly many millions of people around the world could be affected by this.
So this new study that's been released by Imperial College here in London, what does this show us? What does this tell us that is going to move us forward?
Well, it shows that people who were severely ill with COVID in hospital, those who then had these long-lasting long COVID symptoms 6 months later, they looked at their blood, they analysed their blood, and they found that there was evidence of inflammatory markers in their blood. And usually that happens when the immune system is fighting off an infection, so in the middle of COVID. But it's very unusual to see that 6 months down the line. And they also found out that those different inflammatory markers, there were patterns. So those people who were suffering from fatigue or brain fog had slightly different inflammatory markers than people who were suffering from maybe anxiety or had gut problems or other issues. So there was a slight pattern there. And they think that might help in the future to direct where research should go into treatments. We're still, again, at the very early stages, but it's something a bit more than we knew yesterday about long COVID, and it could lead to other research.
Philippa Roxby. Still to come, guess who's joining TikTok? He says he's definitely not going to dance. Find out who he is in a few minutes. Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières has made an urgent appeal for humanitarian agencies that have suspended work in Sudan to return to the country. Nearly a year after fighting began between rival military factions, MSF said a colossal humanitarian crisis was taking place. Nearly 5 million people in Sudan face emergency levels of hunger. One aid agency, the Norwegian Refugee Council, recently warned of the grave danger of an epic famine. I spoke to our Africa correspondent, Anne Soy, and first asked her why the conflict in Sudan had begun.
War broke out nearly almost exactly a year ago on the 15th of April last year between two very armed forces of Sudan, the National Army and the Rapid Support Forces, which was a paramilitary unit created by government to support the army. The generals leading these two forces had been in a power-sharing agreement leading the country. And then there was a power fallout, a political fallout, which then descended into fighting between these two groups. Now, civilians were caught in the middle of this, and they are the ones who have borne the biggest brunt of this war. Millions have been displaced both internally and to neighboring countries. And when we talk about neighboring countries, the conditions have been really dire. We're talking about South Sudan that itself has a serious humanitarian burden back home. We're talking about the Central African Republic, Chad. So things have been very difficult for Sudanese. And today we've heard from MSF, one of the last charities that are trying to help people in Sudan. You know, they're talking about the collapse of the public healthcare system. It was already on its knees before the war. And now between two-thirds and three-quarters of health facilities are not functioning at all. And even they are having difficulty bringing in medical supplies. We have heard about boxes being opened, and if any surgical supplies are found, they're blocked. They are not allowed to go in. Because the thinking is that they're going to help treat those who are wounded in the war, and they could be combatants. International law allows for combatants to be treated. However, those are not being allowed, and the consequence is that they cannot even perform caesarean section to save mothers who are having difficulties giving birth.
Anne Soy. And staying in Africa, reports from Mali say more than 100 people have died in an extreme heat wave, which has seen temperatures soar to more than 45 degrees Celsius over the past 4 days. The BBC's Makoechi Okafor has more details.
One of the largest hospitals in Bamako, Gabriel Touré University Hospital, says that the most affected are people over 60 years and with chronic illnesses. Dr. Boubacar Niari, the Deputy Secretary General for Malian Doctors Union, told the BBC that they are deeply concerned that dozens of people have died due to the heat wave, and the government is looking to find solutions to make sure everyone will be protected if the temperature rises again. The country's health ministry issued a warning advising people to stay hydrated, avoid intense activities, and stay indoors from midday to evening.
China has said it should be allowed to have a normal relationship with Russia after the US warned Beijing not to support Moscow's war in Ukraine. A Chinese government spokesman said the country's ties with Russia should not be disrupted or restricted. The US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who's been on a four-day visit to China, said Chinese businesses could face sanctions if they helped Russia's war effort. And during the trip, Ms. Yellen had this message for her hosts.
China is now simply too large for the rest of the world to absorb this enormous capacity. Actions taken by the PRC today can shift world prices. And when the global market is flooded by artificially cheap Chinese products, the viability of American and other foreign firms is put into question.
With more on the importance of the US Treasury Secretary's visit, here's the BBC's Chinese media analyst, Kerry Allen.
Whenever US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen meets with Chinese officials, you'll see lots of positive language used in Chinese newspapers. She's very much regarded as a friend to China and a key figure in bringing the US and China closer together after years of strained ties amid an ongoing trade war. I'm seeing phrases today amid her China visit like hope, a positive sign, removing barriers and stabilizing relations. I'm even seeing the word chumminess. And long-term state media have spoken about how they appreciate that Janet Yellen has a relatively pragmatic attitude towards China. There's a general feeling that many other US figures who have had high-level exchanges with Chinese officials have either sought to bully or suppress the country. But the China Daily newspaper says, compared with many other US officials, Yellen knows China better and she has direct experience. Before flying to China, Secretary Yellen said her China visit this time was to advance a healthy economic relationship. And from Beijing's perspective, a healthy relationship features openness, equality, and mutual benefits. And these are qualities that China feels Yellen understands. Today, Chinese audiences are watching footage of her enjoying a meal at a Sichuanese restaurant in Beijing. And they're speaking of how she used to regularly enjoy Sichuanese food while teaching at Berkeley. Since arriving in China last Thursday, outlets have been saying that she's had in-depth, candid, pragmatic, and constructive exchanges with Chinese counterparts. And China has had high regards for Yellen, reiterating that she rejects the idea of decoupling economically from China, saying that doing so would bring, quote, disastrous consequences. If there has been a sore point, it's been comments that she's made on how China's excess capacity has distorted global prices and hurt American firms and workers. Media have highlighted that this has been a point of disagreement, and one paper says there's a belief in China that this could be a pretext for more crackdowns on Chinese products and businesses.
Kerry Allen. With elections taking place around the world this year, we know that politicians will be flocking to social media platforms like Facebook and X to get their message across to voters. But now a few brave leaders have decided to go one step further and launch themselves on TikTok. But is the app, known for its short dance videos, the right platform for them, or are they playing with fire? Alfie Habershon reports.
Not the kind of music you might associate with the sober leadership style of German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. But it's him all right. His first video shows a pair of white trainers strolling across a carpet floor, before the camera slowly pans up to the man himself, staring back mischievously from his desk. And he's not the only one taking the TikTok plunge. As European elections approach in June, politicians are hoping to grab the attention of scrolling 16-year-olds, who in Germany, Belgium, Austria and Malta are all allowed to vote. Meanwhile, Mr. Scholz's competition, the far-right Alternative for Germany party, are ahead of the game, with 500,000 followers. But it's never too late to get involved. Just ask 81-year-old US President Joe Biden. He joined in February, during the Super Bowl.
Chiefs or Niners?
Two great quarterbacks, hard to decide. But if I didn't say I was for the Eagles, then I'd be sleeping alone. My wife's a Philly girl.
Jason Kelsey or Travis Kelsey?
Mama Kelsey. I understand she makes great chocolate chip cookies.
Trump or Biden?
Are you kidding? Biden.
Most leaders use the app to deliver short and snappy policy messages. But for others, it's a chance to strip off the suit and just look a bit more natural. At home, reclined on the sofa, or if you're the French president, Emmanuel Macron, fresh from a round of sparring in the boxing gym. But is there a bit more at stake here than public embarrassment? Because German security agencies advise against Mr. Scholz's new hobby. They say that TikTok is probably sharing its user data with the Chinese government. And for the same reason, UK politicians are already banned from using the app altogether. Mr. Biden says he will sign a bill to ban TikTok in America if it passes through the Senate, but he seems a bit torn by getting the most out of it in the meantime, with a looming election runoff against Donald Trump later this year, who is hardly shy on social media himself. For the German Chancellor Scholz, it remains to be seen whether his attempt to get the youth on side will be worth the risks. But it may be a relief to know, whatever his next video, he says he will not be dancing.
Thank goodness for that. Alfie Habershon reporting. Now back to our main story. Tens of millions of sky gazers witnessed the total eclipse of the sun that swept across a broad swathe of North America on Monday. For Professor Sheila O'Moran, who has a visual impairment, it was a special day in Bowling Green in the US state of Ohio.
I can see light and dark, but I don't have any useful vision. So for me, I think what was the most amazing thing was to get the sense of the size of the moon, because it was going at about 1,000 miles an hour. And the idea, you can sort of sense the edge, because really you don't sort of experience the darkness until the moon has completely blocked the sun. And then as soon as the sun comes back, the light comes back and the warmth comes back. So you really get a sense of the edges of the size of the moon, which is quite incredible. The sound does change. It becomes the sound of nighttime. And although it wasn't quiet enough where I was to hear insects, you do get that sense of kind of dulling like you do when it's dark. And obviously the temperature change is the main thing. You know, you get the wind as the moon approaches total eclipse. You get transition from the heat of the sun to the cool of the shadow. And so that's one thing that you notice. And then it is, you know, as cool as it would be in the evening.
And a note for your diary. The next total solar eclipse will be in 2026. It will be visible over the Arctic Ocean and to some people in Europe. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.